Hey, and welcome to Future Thinkers Podcast, episode number 55. So today we've got David Katz, the founder of Plastic Bank, the only organization in the world to successfully turn plastic waste into currency. They're currently doing this by allowing people in the poorest countries to collect and trade plastic in exchange for money and essential goods and services, such as cooking fuel, electricity, schooling, and medicine. So they're hitting two birds with one stone here, reducing plastic pollution and alleviating poverty. The Plastic Bank is also building a platform in partnership with IBM that will integrate the plastic supply chain into global trade and finance ecosystems. David Katz has been honored by the United Nations and the Vatican for his work and has received a number of other awards.
In this episode, we talk about how Plastic Bank works now and David's big vision for it in the future. We also talk about self-actualization and self-sovereignty.
To get all the show notes and links to this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/55.
This episode is brought to you by BitGuild.io. BitGuild is a new gaming platform built using blockchain technology. Their mission is to redefine the relationship between gamers and game developers. On the BitGuild platform, gamers maintain full ownership and control of their virtual items, which are stored on the blockchain. They can transfer items and progress between compatible games, and they can make in-game transactions safely and cheaply, and sometimes free. Developers who join the platform will get a direct link to an established player base with a strong community and a network of like-minded developers building on the same platform. Developers will also have the potential for direct game development funding from BitGuild. The first version of the BitGuild portal is now live. You can log in with MetaMask, buy the Plat token, and play BitGuild's first game, Ether Online. They now have a full inventory wallet system for in-game items. In the coming weeks, the marketplace will be implemented, and several independent developers are joining the site to bring their unique games to the BitGuild family. Go to futurethinkers.org/play to start playing, and join BitGuild's official Discord channel to connect with the team. All right, let's get into it.
Welcome to futurethinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you'd like a list of our top episodes and resources, go to futurethinkers.org/start.
And if you like our podcast, leave us a rating and a review on iTunes and elsewhere. It really helps others find the show, and we really appreciate it.
Do you want to just kind of start giving the audience an introduction to what you're doing and then what's been happening with you lately?
Sure. Well, I'm David Katz, CEO and founder of the Plastic Bank, and we are an ecosystem that reveals value in waste. One of the ways that we do that is creating a store chain for the ultra poor, where everything is available to be purchased using plastic garbage. And we're most proud to offer school tuition and medical insurance and cell phone minutes and Wi-Fi and everything else the world needs and can't afford. And we continue to grow that. And that market approach is very important. It's one way that we create an ecosystem. Some of the things that are up and coming in the store are fuel with a global energy partner, fortified milk powder, critically important for the poor. One of our new relationships is with a multinational pharmaceutical company that wants to see this in Africa and be able to provide an opportunity where we can create small pharmacies using the Plastic Bank model, where the ultra poor now have access to life-saving pharmaceuticals using plastic garbage as cash as well. So having us attached to clinics and other things where poor around the world can just collect enough material to get the life-saving medicines and help that they need. We're even more inspired because in our model, it's about creating that community, that sense of validation and value in the individual. And we love the ideas that even a family in a critical need, a family, an extended family, a village could collect enough material to pay for life-saving access for a villager or for a family member or other things. You know, considering that poverty often is not a lack of material wealth, it's a lack of community and a lack of hope. And within this model, it provides all of that. So many amazing things are happening.
I think most people don't realize that plastic waste actually has value.
I think that the first thing that we need to do is remove the word waste. I think that that is one of the exacerbating concerns with where we're at. Everything has value. Waste is something with no value. That petroleum-based product is a resource. Now, even on the commodity market, it's still worth money. It's worth things. We continue to express, I use a parable, Acres of Diamonds. I changed it a little bit. It's an ancient Persian parable that expresses a goat herder that had a small plot of land and his goats. And he had heard in the distance that people were becoming wealthy by trying to find diamonds. And then, you know, diamonds became something rare and important. So he sold his farm and his goats and went to travel to find this wealth and died a pauper. But the man he sold his farm to, under his feet were acres of diamonds. And it plays the same a little bit with us, that if there is no bank, no store, no way to use those diamonds, they would stay on the ground as rocks. And our sheer presence in communities creates an opportunity for that material's value to be realized. That's really what we do. Now, and that's just one way. Now, we've got a great chain of stores, but it's used as an example with that pharmaceutical organization. We're also a plug-in. So anyone with a simple scale and a smartphone can accept social plastic by weight as a form of payment. And that's a very powerful expression. And then inside of that, as we've continued to build our beautiful global partnership with IBM, is this Hyperledger Fabric blockchain banking application for the poor that allows for the safe, authentic transfer of value globally. So even one of our collectors like Lisa Nassis in Port-au-Prince can deposit her recycling at a center in downtown Port-au-Prince, and her mother could withdraw cooking fuel or cash across the city. Or someone in Germany would be able to deposit the value from the recycling there, and a family could withdraw building bricks or cell phone minutes in the slums of Manila. So it's a way to authentically transfer value globally. And when we see it as value, and we even provide an opportunity for it to be saved and banked and used, that's where we really reveal the value in the material.
It's interesting that you're tackling several different problems with this, because plastic pollution obviously is a huge, huge growing global problem, and there aren't really very many viable solutions for it. Like you said, that plastic is just seen as waste. It's the end of the chain. There's nothing done with it after it's in the ocean. At this point, it could be maybe more profitable for fishermen to go and collect plastic than to collect fish.
Yes, that is the truth. And that is something that we're creating in a small island archipelago in Indonesia currently, because the fishermen have overfished the reef so much, they're becoming more destitute every day. The reef will never recover because they're trying to catch the last few fish. And certainly being able to create an alternative income source that allows them to also use their boats to transport that material becomes profoundly important for the entire world. Now, there are 8.3 trillion kilos of plastic on the earth. All the plastic we've ever produced as humans is mostly still here as waste. 8.3 trillion kilo. Now, the material, as we sell it to our customers, is roughly a dollar a kilo. But if, let's say, take 50 cents per kilo, we're potentially unleashing a $4 trillion value for the earth. But that's only if we realize that value once. Plastic being almost infinitely recyclable with additive, even without additive, recyclable 8 times, almost. So what if we use that material and continue to spend that with a marginal propensity to consume, where that money is spent again and again and again in society? When we reveal that market potential, that monetary system, how many trillions of dollars can we unleash for the planet? I would argue that we've inadvertently been depositing the very value, the very resource at the fingertips of society to change all of it, to change humanity, and becoming unifying in our stewardship of each other and the planet. It transcends borders, languages, religions, all philosophies, bringing everyone together around the one ocean that we have.
What's unique about the time and the state of technology that we have now that allows for this, that was just simply impossible a number of years ago?
Advancements in the technology include the ability to return plastic to food grade. Now, food grade material is a small percentage of where plastic is used, but relevant in single use and other things. So food grade is important, and the technology exists to be able to transfer that material, making it recyclable again and using it back into packaging. That's important. There's a advancement in a process called pyrolysis, which using pressure and heat returns plastic back into a fuel, in essence. There's even advancements in pyrolysis that will return it back into virgin plastic. So you can throw in all material types, all mixed material with organics, with everything. And with a process of pressure and heat, we'll return it back to a monomer, which allows it then to become a virgin plastic again. I mean, it really returns it to a virgin state. The technology on the planet exists today to solve the problems that we're encountering. Absolutely. The challenge is where we hear in society, in serving the base of the pyramid, this last mile distribution, this is a reverse challenge. It's last mile collection. That's what we're becoming globally renowned for, last mile collection of the material. It doesn't matter how many processing facilities, paralysis facilities, if no one's out collecting the material, it's never going to work. That's where we're at. And we recognize that that needs to occur through incentive. See, a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. You can't go and convince someone to go and recycle. You can't convince them to go pick it up for the goodness of society. It's about creating an incentive for them as they see themselves. So what do they need? Tuition. What do they need? Food. What do they need? Medicine. The basic pyramid. How can you can't transcend that hierarchy of needs when you live there? You'll always be a burden, always serving self in that basic pyramid. And so when we take a bottle and provide an opportunity for someone to go to school with it, we use examples in Haiti where education is $20 a month. It's all user paid there. No government education. So $20 a month. Well, 200,000 school-age children today currently can't go to school that want to go to school, meaning that a 9 million, 10 million person population will really never be able to end poverty. There's 200,000 children today. How about last year, the year before, next year? Will continue to perpetuate sheer illiteracy, sheer poverty, never end there. So $20 a month now provides an opportunity for children to go to school. But when a family looks at that plastic, it's not the $20 a month that it's replacing. When they look at the bottle now, it's not $20. It's not even this education. When they look at the bottle, it's the end of poverty. So what's the long-term benefit of ending poverty in the generations of your family? See, it's not $20 a month now. And see, it's definitely not a bottle anymore. And what it's definitely not, UV, is waste. Because that is hope, that is change, that is prosperity, that is my social security as a parent, that is everything to put my child in school. And that's a paradigm shift.
It's so interesting how you've been able to find the incentives to, you know, without waste, you actually are returning something back to people and the planet. And I'm wondering what other kind of parallels you see. You know, you've obviously made a very clean switch in this mindset to thinking about profit a different way and incentivization a different way. What other kind of parallels of big problems in the world do you see there being opportunities or other companies are already doing something about it?
Well, within the plastic space and within the plastic bank, when we resonate on the name, where we are moving towards and what we are working to provide is the authentication of self, financial inclusion. But let's take a look inside of financial inclusion, because what we're providing is credit rating. So with the consistency of return, with the quality of the product that you return back to our center, when you return it to a high quality state, when you've brought in other collectors, taking in Mohamed Yunus's, you know, work in microfinance, and part of the high success in repayment rates comes from having mastermind groups. When someone receives a small microloan, they have three or four other people that vouch for them. So when we take a high quality return rate, when we take a collector that's returning material consistency of high quality, bringing in other collectors into the fray as well that also vouch, that also have a high success and return rate with consistency, certainly we can provide a credit worthiness. But I think more importantly inside that, we can also provide a debt service ratio, because we know how much they make. We now have the ability to give access into an earnings, which is not possible with the poor. So we give an earnings plus a credit worthiness. So we can create true financial inclusion and removing the 30, 34% interest rates that the poor are inflicted with in the African continent. 34%, somewhere between 29, 34% is the average interest rate to the poorest of the poor in the world. That has to change. Think of that. And so now we can provide low interest rates. And where I want to go with that ultimately is to be a mortgage holder for the poor and to give them access to own land and have interest at low appropriate interest rates for the poor that give them access into earnings, savings, home ownership, and everything else that's required. And then from that as well, we certainly need to be within underwriting our own insurance. You know, we've found micro insurers around the world that for 80 cents a month, we can give you critical illness insurance. 80 cents a month. And so the power there lies in the family, in the mother of the home. So if the husband is out predominantly doing high risk work, without safety equipment, without anything, without shoes. I mean, imagine being in America and putting people in a construction site in flip-flops. Well, that occurs, that's most of the world. And so what happens when you are injured and your family relies on your sense of income? You're destitute today. And that's what would happen around the world. So now with critical illness insurance, it allows the mother of the home to go out and collect in a couple of hours the amount of value needed to pay for the insurance. So if something happens to the husband, they're still insured and they still have food on the table and can still pay their rent. We give access to self-sufficiency where it didn't exist before. And then what other model lies within financial inclusion? We have to consider as well that one out of every three children born today will still never have a birth certificate. And most banks, most institutions, how will they ever be able to loan you money within their realms? Well, with us, it's all based on the amount that you collect. We just give you an opportunity to prove it. Go prove it. Go collect. Now, not only are you collecting, not only are you bringing in and creating an income for yourself and allowing yourself this level of hope to be able to transcend some of the challenges you encounter, but long term, we even give you further long term hope that you get a credit rating, that you might have an opportunity to now own a home, things that were not fathomable before. And what we need to lie in the consideration of that is that long term or long time perspective is as well a beautiful immediate access to the alleviation of poverty. Because when you live in poverty, you're only thinking of the next minute, next 10 minutes, next hour. You know, when we can look at success and we can take a reference, look at drug addicts and alcoholics. Their time perspective is immediate. It's the next hour. It's the next hit. It's the next drink. Immediate time perspective. Look at the Gateses of the world. Look at the Buffets of the world. Their time perspective is decades. That time perspective is a critical element that predicts success. And when we can take the abject poor and now give them time perspective that might be 5 years, 10 years down the road, or land ownership that can look at 20 years down the road, decades down the road, that's a profound societal shift. That's what we're doing.
That time perspective thing is quite interesting too. When you think about, you know, the big successful people who think in those decades kind of terms, I've often, this is a total side note and sidetrack, but I've often thought about giant constructions like cathedrals or the pyramids, that kind of thing, like what people had to, the time frames they had to think about to even construct those things. And we never attempt anything like that in the modern age. Nothing longer than a year for most people.
At least in the Western world.
Yeah, in the West, for sure. I mean, look at us with a queen. I mean, look at the degradation that is occurring in the society and the individuals. Look at sugar. Look at everything else that's occurring. Their time perspective has shifted. And we are as a result of short time perspective, immediacy, immediate gratification. It's not hard to have some insight into what is occurring with it. It all becomes self in that moment, right? No time perspective. It's all in, you know, egoistic attachment. I want to immediately feel like I'm not bad, or immediately want to feel like I'm good. That's what's occurring.
Or be safe.
Yeah. Sure.
And of course, there's all this other stuff that is built on top of that, because, you know, when people are in that kind of a second away from panic state, then you can manipulate them very easily. And of course, you know, political parties and gangs and all these different formal and informal institutions, churches in the third world or in the first world, just prey on those instincts. So if you can get people out of that state, you make them more sovereign on many levels.
And it's possible to do. And, you know, our application really is product agnostic or material agnostic. You know, currently the plastic bank and the immediate need for the planet is to ensure that we monetize waste to such an extent that it is really viewed as acres of diamonds or oceans of diamonds in this case. And being able to provide an incentive for the plastic to never enter in the ocean to begin with, which is the most important element. That's really what we need to do, is turning off the tap is most important. Too many people talk about cleaning the ocean, which is ridiculous. We have to, you know, and I use it in my speeches that if you're walking into the kitchen, the sink is overflowing and you're going to bucket, a mop and a plunger in a moment of panic, you've got to choose. Well, most people forget that they need to turn the tap off. And that's what we need to be doing as a society, as a humanity, turn the tap off, stop the flow of plastic from entering the ocean to begin with. Then we can go and tackle the ocean. But let's go turn off the tap, prohibit the flow of plastic. This is one of those ways to do that.
So how are you guys doing that?
We do that by providing an incentive for the poor that lets them realize the value of the material, because no one ever throws away cash, especially the poor. If every bottle that you saw in Bulgaria, in the streets of Bulgaria, or anywhere that you went in the world, forgive the currency, but if every bottle was €5, $5, £5, how many would you see in the environment? Would you see any in the ditch at £5? No, you wouldn't. You'd go clamor, hey, that's £5. I'm going to go get that. There's a couple there. It's, you know, 20, it's 30, it's whatever. None, of course not. So it's not the bottle, it's us. It goes to prove that it's us. It's our perspective on it. It's the story that we've placed on that material. And I would then really be able to argue an unconscious story that we've been provided and we're acting unconsciously. So we provide a consciousness. We provide an opportunity for people to be in service of self and be present in the collection of the material. So they can see that it's of high value and it stays in a state that's high value. And if it's high value, it's never going to enter the ocean. They won't throw it away. I mean, how many places have I been where they just take all the material and just dump it in the river? There's a river flowing by. I'll just dump it on the side. And eventually the tide will come in or the river will run to such a level that it'll take it away. That's the only opportunity for most. That or burn it. And then you live within all of the disease and everything that occurs from it.
Yeah, in all of our travels in the last few years, that's one of the most notable things in certain locations you go to in Thailand and Bali is the disgusting beaches because they're just so covered in plastic. And there's like a plastic time of the month where the tides are especially bringing them in.
It's gotten really, really bad in the last couple of years. And, you know, in Western countries, at least they have some sort of systems for dealing with it. But in places like Indonesia, they just don't. And it's really noticeably bad.
There's just no opportunity. When the population lives in abject poverty, when the government can't authentically afford, you know, medical care or foodstuffs, or what do you do? And then the challenges with Indonesia, you know, somewhere up to 20,000 islands, no garbage truck drives by. That doesn't occur. And then the world is, you know, continuing to rush to try to provide items for the poor. So multi-layer sachets, small individual portions, things like that, all of it coming out in plastic. And so, there's no waste infrastructure. The brands don't take responsibility for that. They're really just focused on messaging. They're really just focused on shareholder value, which is really what's gotten us to where we are. Shareholder value, individual value, value for myself over others, value for myself over the world. They're not in business for planet value. That's evident. Look, just go to the beach. That is evident. Individual value, shareholder value is why we are where we are today. We're having a conversation about this because the insular concepts of shareholder value.
In Western countries, at least there's some sort of media pressure and social pressure for these companies to at least appear eco-friendly. And so they appear that way in the West. But, you know, a lot of their production facilities are not in the West, so they don't have to do anything decent over there.
But it's beginning. We see it. There's a change in the tide and consumers are starting to understand that they have a voice and they've got a greater voice today than they ever have. And brands are listening and they're listening really in the same regard, shareholder value, because the, you know, brands are trying to provide what the customers want, because if they don't, they're going to lose sales. And the conversation here with anyone that may be listening is to recognize that they are immensely powerful. Especially in this digital age, we're the most powerful consumer generation in history. We actually have voice. They listen to us. There are teams of people listening for conversation around the brands. And if you're truly passionate or know that you can make a difference or a difference needs to be made, you need to speak up and communicate with the brands that they should be using materials that have profound social and societal change, and that you don't want to buy anything that doesn't have value for the planet. And if you have an opportunity to buy something that can provide value for the planet, make societal change, end poverty, clean the ocean, or you can buy something that degrades the planet. And so demand that corporations use material and product and distribution that provide value for everyone.
So one of the things we like to do with Future Thinkers is to try and highlight people who are doing incredible things, talk about what they're doing, kind of get exposure for that, but also try and figure out what makes them different and what kind of, if any, key points in their lives made them switch the way they think to start thinking differently and then put them on the path to start taking action. So is there any kind of event in your life that made you really start changing the way you thought?
It is a very common question for us. And I'm going to give you two answers. I'm going to give you the first, the authentic answer, the appropriate answer is that we are the summation and accumulation of all the experiences and all the decisions that we've ever made in our lives. So the answer, truly the authentic answer is no. I'm where I am today, and you are where you are today because of all of the experiences and everything that you've ever done. So no, there wasn't. Now, there might have been some that set you on a different path more profoundly that you paid attention to, but they were all important, and all of mine were important. The dysfunction of my childhood, the violence that I experienced in my childhood, my origin of being memories where my father was beating my mother, I'm here because of that as well. I'm all of that. Everything was a gift in my life. Now, that's the whole different conversation. And profoundly, I was at sea with my father. My father built a 15-meter sailboat by himself from the Halap. He sailed the west coast of North America. I met him. We sailed together. And on the way back up out of San Francisco, sailing back towards Victoria, which is on an island outside of Vancouver, nautical miles away from shore, offshore sailing in a 60 knot wind and a 20 foot wave. On our third dawn, my father had a heart attack in this storm, and giving me his last testament and jewelry and words for my mother, as he thought that he was dying, I had to call a mayday to the U.S. Coast Guard, take command of the vessel and sail us back to shore, continue communicating with the Coast Guard, looking for that help and trying to be cause in my own matter. And what I learned in those moments was not just the beauty and majesty and the raw power of the sea and the ocean, but that if it was to be, it was up to me. And that in that moment, I learned that I was infinitely powerful and responsible and was able to be in charge of my own destiny and creation. So that was one of those quintessential moments, one of these origin of beings where I learned that I could take care of things. That was one for sure. And that time at the ocean, our family home was at the beach, and I was able to continue to witness the degradation of the ocean early on. I've been in this space for decades. I've been aware of what's been occurring for decades, where many are just becoming awakened to it today. So as well, I've had that lifetime moment to see what's occurring. As well, in my entrepreneurial life, I've been able to be focused on the knowing that we see what we think about. I take people through an experience and I have them look around for a color. I have them look intently in the knowing that they should close their eyes and be able to appoint that color. But when I ask them to close their eyes, I change the color they should look for. And in that moment, they recognize that what they think about is what they see. They have no ability to see any other color because they've been so focused on the one I asked them for. And I've directed my life into seeing and looking for those things that I want to occur, not what I don't want to occur. And even in the story of the environmental degradation and what is occurring in the oceans today, people are focused on the problem. And we need to be in this experience of being focused on the solutions that we need, not the problem. All these conferences about what's occurring in the oceans. Oh, look what's happening in the ocean. Look at the degradation. Look what's happening. Look, here's another study of how many more animals have died. Here's another thing about, you know, ocean acidification. Here's one more about, oh, wow, what an overwhelm. Problems everywhere. Oh, my goodness. And so we're only seeing problems. And so now we're in this place where we truly need to be in a place where we're looking for solutions. And so it's a combination of all those things. So there isn't any one moment. And I don't think anyone else can tell you that there was one moment, because that one moment only appeared as a summation of all the other moments they had in their life, which they didn't pay attention to. So there isn't. And everything is a gift inside of it. There is no one moment. Everything is a gift. And the moment that you sit back and go, wow, my entire life was a gift. Everything inside of it was a gift. Everything in life points me to the unlimited creation of life. And you're open to see the solutions of life. When you sit back and are focused on the problems of life, of course, you'll never see solutions.
And if you see yourself as a creator, then why would you be creating more misery or more problems?
That's all we are, is the creator. We are the creator. I'm a part of creation. I am a creator. I'm a part of the creation. Whatever that creator is for you. Something was created. I've been created. So I am a part of the creator. I am the creator. I create. So we all are. We are creators. We're the creator having a human experience.
It really makes sense when certain sort of cultural phenomenon really take hold. Like the, say, for example, the social justice warrior movement in the United States and UK. Certain places where poverty is quite high. I always refer to it as reality is thick here. Like people, there's a common belief system. A lot of people believe this, and reality is thick and it's like sludge moving through it because people aren't free in the way they think. And so to me, it makes sense why certain places you go, the problems are a lot worse and the fear is a lot higher and that sort of stuff, is because people are taking on these sort of victim roles, especially the social justice warrior thing. It's all about victimhood, identifying as the victim.
I'm going to chat about something that's probably... And I say this, so understanding that there's the tremendous challenges for women in the world. I can understand this controversy that Tony Robbins encountered recently with his expression that the Me Too movement was diminishing for women. And he ultimately received a lot of negativity with that. And I understand his expression was that women became identified with victimhood, or victimization. And the Me Too movement gave it reality, gave it form. And so that drove these legions of women to be in the position that they are victims. I get it. As opposed to living in the unlimited power. I get what's happened. We understand that can occur. But to stay in that ego mind that helps, that continues to establish and substantiate our position into the identity of something at one fixed point in the past is not the unlimited power that women have. We need to be in a position to unleash that power, and they can be in the solution and creation of a new reality.
Yeah, that's so perfectly said.
I agree. And it's not denying the experience. The experience might have been horrible, but it doesn't mean that you don't have a life after that. You have a life. You go out, you do things. In some cases, a traumatic experience can actually give people new fuel for the future, new hope. Like, you know, Viktor Frankl's book was an amazing example of that. A Man's Search for Meaning, surviving the concentration camps for years, and then how he came out of that and rebuilt himself and was able to build a life and a family and everything.
You know what? I think that you've even in that conversation, it wasn't what occurred after that was so relevant in Viktor Frankl's work. It was the way he chose to see the present in it. It's what was occurring in the consciousness that he and the work here really is that in that space between condition and response is our life. We choose in that moment. And perhaps the theme of this conversation that we began it with, what was the moment? There wasn't. There was a successive realization of this. And that every moment as I approached it in life, I got to make a decision on how it appeared to me. And that is exactly the work of Viktor Frankl in the concentration camp. He got to appear it as something that set him free, that was beautiful and everything else, where the people who died had no hope. They decided that in the future, somehow that wasn't going to appear, and they resigned themselves and died. What extended his life in those years in the concentration camp was the immediate decision in between the condition that he was in and how he would respond to it. He made a decision, and I think that part of this conversation here as well is this, in this victimhood, is that people are deciding to identify with being a victim. And that comes as well from media and other things. And, you know, and there's a lot of egoistic decision and all of that. So that's a whole different conversation.
It's an interesting thing looking at our, I shouldn't say necessarily our generation, because it's a lot of generations in the last, you know, 50 or so years, but the way people are kind of a lot more sheltered, not allowing themselves, or their parents never allowed them to be exposed to dangers or getting dirty, anything like that. It was, I think the term was helicopter parents for our generation, and everyone talks about participation ribbons and that kind of thing. Like there is an isolation of challenge and difficulty that I think now has really shown up in this sort of adoption of the victim mentality, because people haven't had successes of overcoming a trauma or a difficulty or a challenge. They don't have like a wealth of those memories of overcoming something to pull from and go, I'm capable of this. I can do something with this because I've done it before. I've done something worse than this before.
Amen. I think that's very important and well said.
I wrote an article actually recently that talked about choice and responsibility and victimhood and seeing it from a different light. You know, when people resort to a victim mentality, they basically give up their sovereignty. And in it, there's a certain sense of safety because you don't have to take responsibility for anything. But of course, it's reducing your sovereignty, your ability to do something. It reduces your agency. So it's a two-sided coin. It's on one hand, the sense of safety, but it's not real. It's you're just reducing your sphere of influence and saying, this is my little bubble, I'm safe here, and out there is dangerous, so I'm not even going to think about it.
Yeah, that's interesting, though, because things have a tendency of moving in whatever direction you are focused in.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're protecting yourself and like sticking the border there. Like the border, if you're moving it back, it's continuing to move back until you resist and push it forward.
It will advance.
Like it doesn't stay still anywhere.
Yeah, the chaos will advance on your little bubble.
Yeah, exactly. You will see your sovereignty disappear even more.
And interesting to tie this back into where we started even earlier about giving people the sovereignty to go out and do something with the resources that they have, as small as they might be. You know, go find this plastic, do something with it, and then in a small way, that is empowering because you feel like, oh, there are actually opportunities out there. And it's a mental trigger that gets you into the mindset of, oh, opportunities. And then you find more opportunities and more opportunities, and it cascades.
This makes me curious about how young people in the West respond to Plastic Bank and to what you're doing. Are they as excited about this as they are in third world countries?
They're excited about the opportunity. There lies a solution. I think everyone is in this fear currently. And I think it's part of the reason why the ocean cleanup project is getting as much of attention as it is, although ridiculous in nature. Now, I wish it well, and I hope that sending out this big boom in the ocean can have any significance. I think that that's nice. It's well-meaning. it brings attention, but I think that the world is looking at it because they want an easy solution. They want someone else to come in and fix it.
Yeah.
And I think we are still suffering from a conversation we just had.
Yeah. Daddy, come and save me.
Come and save me. Someone else do something about it. Now, that's not necessarily 100% true. We find people to be in action and participation. We have a flood of people that are looking to participate, to be a part of this movement, the social plastic revolution. And we are igniting an ecosystem that is bringing humanity together to be in the action of localized solution that has global impact. And that really is the plastic bank is... We are really express it as a conduit for change, an opportunity for the entire world to participate in. And so we are an ecosystem. We are not a solution. We are not any one thing. Inside of everything, everything lies inside of this. I create a story here that a young woman on the Ivory Coast that might have a computing sciences scholarship has the ability in our platform to create a plugin that allows her mother, who sells vegetables on the side of the road, a point of sale system that with her smartphone, because she already has a scale with her smartphone, can accept the value of social plastic as a form of payment. And so now with a point of sale system that her daughter created that plugs into our ecosystem, allows her mother to be able to serve more people and have her own social impact. So, I mean, we haven't encountered areas around the world where the poor themselves are not disgusted by where they live, but they just live, they resign themselves to the condition. They don't like it, but they resign themselves. So now we have an opportunity for the entire world to be in a solution together. So the mother has the ability to sell more customers, serve more people, and she gets to have her own social, societal, and environmental impact. The daughter as well participated by creating a plugin that not just her mother gets to use, but now it becomes an open platform for the entire world. So any vegetable seller in the world can use this plugin. And so every vegetable seller in the world gets to participate in the change of the environment in their community. Or perhaps someone creates something for taxis, or perhaps it's going to be bike share for the poor or other things. Now, that further expression, we've encountered a solar lamp, powerful for the world, solar power, solar lamp. There's many. The uniqueness in this one is a chipset that allows for two-way communication with the phone. Not only does it charge the phone, but it allows for the value to be transferred into the light. So now as a social plastic collector, you have a value in your bank account. Now you attach your phone to the light. And instead of me selling you the lamp, I sell you the light. Now you can do a microtransaction. You can transfer value from your bank account into the light. So you turn on the light when you need it. So you're only paying for the things you need, which is what the poor need. Now, more powerfully, one of our interactions with brands in the North is that when you return a bottle in the North, you have the ability through a social activation or a brand activation, when you recycle one of the products you bought in the North, when you return that, a value will be transferred to a lamp around the world. So buy a bottle of shampoo in Germany, and when you recycle that, value will be given to the poor in the form of light, right? So it's safe, authentic transfer of value globally. It's a conduit that allows everyone to participate in change. Those are just some of the examples.
If you have APIs that can use existing apps and existing systems that can just plug in,
now, I hesitate to use open source, but, you know, it's an open platform that allows, through an API, everyone in the world an opportunity to participate in the value that is created through recycling, through stewardship. And in that essence, like, let's say you've got something, let's say you're a taxi share. If you give a slight discount, if you give a 10% discount in your service to people who have collected social plastic, what it actually does is provides a price increase for the value that was collected, for the plastic that was collected. It provides further incentive for the poor because the money inside of the system goes further. It's one way to also increase the price of the material that allows the entire world to contribute. Huh. And then through gamification, incentivization, that's additional way. And I communicate that we continue to want to be the Candy Crush of recycling.
Nice.
And then within all of that, imagine that you're a collector in Nairobi, and now you've just collected your first 1,000 kilos of material. And on your app, all of a sudden you're getting words of encouragement from around the world because the world recognizes that you just reached a milestone. And so you were the absolute abject, illiterate, and poor before, feeling absolutely unseen. And now people from around the world are sending you love. Oh, that on its own can be a profound shift to give you a greater world perspective. You're taking people who have never left a village before.
Yeah.
And connecting them to the world. We're taking the world and having them connect to a village.
I've been thinking about this gamification element quite a bit. We just had a recent sponsor from a blockchain gaming company, and they're tokenizing basically gaming assets, so skins and that kind of stuff. And I thought the whole concept of that was quite interesting because there's perceived value in these skins and these digital assets. And when it comes to incentivizing people through gamification, is that an element that you are thinking about, which is like releasing limited content and limited badges or that kind of thing?
Like leaderboards, some sort of recognition, reputation points.
Absolutely. It all has to exist in there. It's just a human dynamic. And what's the incentive for the poor, especially? And then it should be leveling up as well. It should be also tied into a financial performance. Now you've brought in three collectors. Okay, that takes you to a different price point for the material you receive. Or let's say the special incentives, those people who have brought in three other collectors into the ecosystem, they're the ones that get to participate in a higher price. And all of that dynamic, that has to be built out. That's part of the roadmap. There's just so much to do. You know, set aside, like, we're not just building an application. I mean, we're, you know, we're also influencing the poor. We're on the ground. We're multinational now. We're also a sales organization working with the world's largest organization. So we're going to be a sales organization. We're in logistics. We're on the ground. We're working with the abject illiterate. We're in areas of danger. You know, we need to continue. There's just so much we need to, which is where I get back to being a conduit, which is an invitation for everyone to participate. And even anyone listening here, if they think that they can participate somehow, or if they've got a special uniqueness, a skill of some sort, I invite you to reach out to us. There may be a very real way for you to participate. And we are always looking for remarkable people. Always. And so if there's something that you can contribute, some way you want to be a part of this, then reach out to us. That's easy. Plasticbank.org and participate. Absolutely.
What kind of partnerships are you guys looking for right now specifically?
What are we looking for? We'll never end. Now, the purpose of any business is to find customers and keep them. We're a for-profit solution. So certainly we continue to be a sales organization that continues to influence global brands to participate in a brand activation opportunity that helps end poverty and prevent the ocean from needing to be cleaned. And so that's very, very important for us. And then on the technology side, we continue to build out this banking application. So people within banking and certainly within incentivization and gaming, those are all very important for us. I mean, it doesn't end. And I don't know. I only know today what I already know. So I don't know what I don't know. And there may be other parts of this and the creativity of this. And if people are listening to this, and I just assume that your audience is more creative than most. And if they lie in this, they have an idea of what about this? What about that? That I invite anyone to participate and reach out and give us ideas as well. Those are all very, very important. One thing I am looking for is that I am looking to create a sub $4 digital Bluetooth scale, hanging scale that will interact with our app like Square, but for social plastic. It's a hanging scale that anyone can have access to. When you just weigh the material and by mass, it automatically reveals the value on the app. So it becomes two-way authenticated quickly. Each participant agrees to the weight and the value of it. I need a Bluetooth scale.
Cool. Interesting. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about before we end the show?
I can't end it without reminding everyone here that whatever you buy is what the world is going to produce. They listen all the time. And if you continue to buy single-use material and you continue to disregard what is occurring today, then that's what they're going to produce. But if you are a voice in that, if you are a cause in the matter, when you show up and express that the world needs to be producing and presenting items that are good for the world, that have a holistic approach, that's what they'll provide as well. It's business for them too. They will sell what you ask for. And if you are asking for excessive packaging, single-use material, degradation of the environment, that's what they're going to do. So show up, be a cause in the matter, be the powerful, unlimited soul that you are, be the creator in the change.
Great.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to end this.
Yeah.
Awesome.
David, thanks for joining us. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate it very much. You also are now causing the matter. Thank you.
All right, that's all for this episode. For all the links and show notes, go to futurethinkers.org/55. And to check out our sponsor, BitGuild, go to futurethinkers.org/play.
If you're new to the show and you'd like a list of our top episodes and resources, go to futurethinkers.org/start. If you want to sponsor our show, go to futurethinkers.org/sponsor.
If you like our podcast, leave us a rating and a review on iTunes and elsewhere. It helps others find the show, and we really appreciate it. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode. Bye! Bye. Bye.